Hey, everyone, and welcome to the New Visionary Podcast, a podcast for artists who are ready to reach greater heights in their art careers. I'm your host, Victoria J. Fry, founder of Visionary Art Collective and New Visionary Magazine. Join me for inspiring conversations with some of the most inspirational visionaries in today's art world. Let's jump in. Welcome back, beautiful souls. Today we have a very, very exciting episode. We are diving in with Dan Lam, an American sculptor of Vietnamese ancestry, best known for her drippy sculptures and use of vibrant color. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy you're here. I mean, we were just chatting a little bit before we started recording. I was totally fangirling over your work and just sharing how much I love your work, your drippy sculptures. They're so beautiful. And I was also sharing that your videos, I find them to be very relaxing and cathartic to watch. So I'm just so happy you're here. I'm excited to talk with you. And I can't wait to share a little bit more about your work with our listeners.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here as well. Yeah, I can't wait.
So I have been following you on social media for a while, and I think like one of the really, I don't know, just cool things, you've grown your account, you've really established a presence, and I think you really use like social media as an amazing tool to share your work and put it out there. But can you tell us a little bit about your journey as a visual artist and how it's kind of been developing your work and your style and also building your career as an artist?
Sure. Yeah. So I did go to school for art. I went to University of North Texas for my undergrad, and then I went to Arizona State for my master's degree. And it was, you know, I think when a lot of people are starting out in the arts and they go the academic route, there's kind of, there's not very many paths because it's a risky path to take, right? To want to become like a full-time artist. So I did the master's because I thought, well, I'll do what everyone else has done where I graduate with my master's. It's a terminal degree for fine arts. So I can teach at a college. So adjunct, you know, maybe get tenure somewhere, long-term, whatever. That was like the bigger picture. And one of the main reasons why I went and got my master's, and I went straight from undergrad into grad school. Yeah. So that's when I started working with a lot of the materials I work with today, a lot of like exploration of just non-traditional media. My degrees are actually in painting and drawing. So the programs I were in, they were very supportive of like kind of stepping outside the box in that way and getting real experimental with it. So yeah, I graduated in 2014 and I spent a year. I did adjunct at a community college. And that's really the time that I got on social media. I had moved from Arizona to a small town in Texas. It was just a year's time. But during that time, it was a big shift because I was used to, you know, the environment and community of a school and having people, like-minded people around, sharing thoughts and ideas and all of that. And suddenly that was gone. And so I thought, well, Instagram was getting really popular at the time. I think it had already been in progress for like a few years, but I was like, I'll get on and make it a point to start posting and engaging and connecting with other people to build a community, to make up for the grad school experience that had shifted. So yeah. So 2015, I started posting a lot and sharing process videos and all of that. And then 2016, I went full-time art. And then since then, it's been 8 years now. It was a really interesting time, especially in the beginning, because, you know, social media wasn't something that had become like an integral part of being an artist. So in school, we weren't taught how to use social media. I don't know if kids are taught that now. I don't know if that's a part of the dialogue still. I've heard that sometimes it's kind of shamed. It's a little taboo, you know, still maybe looked down upon, whatever, but it was not taught in school. So when I was becoming full-time, I kind of had to navigate how to use it, the opportunities came my way, what to say yes to, what to say no to. And a lot of that was at the time like kind of confusing because, you know, when you're young and you're getting a lot of opportunities to come your way, you want to say yes to everything. But, you know, it's like maybe certain things didn't align with where you wanted your work to go or where your career path to go. So it was difficult because I didn't have really anyone to reach out to be like, hey, what do I do? This is new. I couldn't reach out to my professors that I, you know, was so close to in school because they hadn't gone through any of the same things. So early on, it was a lot of that. It was a lot of like just discerning what was right, what wasn't right for me, and just figuring it out. And then, you know, you make mistakes along the way. You say yes to something that maybe you shouldn't have said yes to, and you just kind of learn like, oh, well, I should have listened to my gut. Like, that wasn't right. And then you move forward and you take that lesson into the next yes or no or whatever.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for sharing that. And like, I appreciate you opening up and telling us a bit about your journey and also just your transparency because, you know, most full-time artists that I speak with share that like it ebbs and flows and that there are challenges that come with that. And I think that's like, I mean, it's like anything, but yeah, I just appreciate your openness in talking a little bit about your journey. And I think at the beginning, it is hard to always know what the right opportunities are. And you kind of just have to like try so many different things to get to that place where you figure it out. When you made the decision to go full time with your art, how did that feel? Did it feel like a big leap of faith? Did you feel really secure in that decision? And I'm sure it was like a whole mix of things, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So it was kind of one of those things that just ended up happening. So I moved back to Dallas in the end of 2015 into 2016. And I was in a group show out in California with this gallery called Left Field. And it's in this town called San Luis Obispo. It's in the middle of California, very beautiful town, really cool gallery. It's owned by an artist named Nick Wilkinson. He's super cool. He's got a lot of different hustles and he was just a really good person to meet at that time. And he put me in this group show. It was a 4-person show. And we ended up selling like all of my sculptures that was in this group show. And so I had gotten like a part-time job when I moved back to Dallas. And it wasn't a good fit. I didn't like it. It was a big like internal struggle. And then I sold these works and I was like, well, you know, I have rent for the next like 3 months, you know, I can make this work. So I just kind of, I quit the part-time job and then I just went with it because I knew at least I had at least 2-3 months ahead where I can keep figuring it out. And so it was risky. It was a little scary. I'm sure my mom was like super nervous for me, you know, like all of that. But I think too, as time went on and I learned, like I had never looked at myself as like a small business. But essentially, this is that. I am a full-time artist. I have to do all the things that a small business would have to do. And so once you kind of look at yourself like that, it's a weird thing to look at because, you know, with art, you don't look at it like that. But once you kind of change the context a little bit and you understand that you are a small business, it is a brand up to a certain point, however much you want to push that, then you kind of give yourself a little bit more leeway, I think, because like I learned that, you know, a lot of small businesses, when they start, it takes like 3 to 5 years before they start turning a profit. And so at the time, you know, I was like just kind of inching my way, like, okay, month by month, 2 months ahead, whatever, just figuring it out. But once I had made it past that 3-year threshold, I was like, oh my gosh, like that's what I just went through, was that 3 years of like that struggle, not knowing if, you know, you get like these checks, but then it ebbs and flows. Sometimes you get a bunch of commissions, you sell a bunch of work and it's good. And then it dips. And you can't control how that goes. There's a lot of different factors at play. Yeah. Once you're kind of out of that timeline, it was scary. And it was risky, but I think as long as you kind of have your priorities right as to like making sure you can cover your bills, cover what you need to be creative, all of that, then it's a little bit easier. And I had like student loans and all of that stuff as well. So it's very real and it can be stressful. But yeah, I would say though, it took like 3 years, 3.5 years before I felt solid.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I, again, like really appreciate your transparency because this is just the reality of what it's like when you're a full-time artist, when you're an entrepreneur. And I think you know, from what you're sharing, because I experienced this as well in my own business. I went full time with VAC nearly 3 years ago. I launched the company four years ago, but it's been 3 years of full time, and very similar. I can relate to so much of what you're saying. I'm like, yes, it's exactly how I felt. And I think a lot of it too is like, just to your point of, there's so much kind of out of your control. Like, you don't always know where the money is coming in. You can only control like what is, I don't know, I guess your mindset and your response and how you handle things and showing up and being as consistent as you can be, and kind of like your approach. And I think it requires so much trust as well. Like, not always trust that everything's going to work out, but trust that even if things are hard, you're going to find a solution, like you're going to figure it out, and that it will ultimately work out somehow. So I just appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's a beautiful thing that you had that moment where your work sold and you kind of realized, okay, I can actually do this. Like, it's very reaffirming, I feel, to have an experience like that. After you had that experience, what helped you to continue growing your collector base? Did you continue exhibiting? I know you've had so many group and solo shows over the past few years. Can you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, I think it just kept snowballing from that point. I had people who reached out to me directly on Instagram, because at the same time, my account was growing a lot. And, you know, the algorithm was different back then. So my videos or posts would get categorized into niches that were outside of just the art world. So I was getting a lot of eyes, a lot of people who were not just like art lovers, but people adjacent to all of that. So that was a really interesting thing, because I would have people who reached out to me and were like, oh, I want to buy something, and I could sell directly to them. That was new. That was something that I didn't really think about, I think, in school, you know, like this, that this could be an avenue for getting my work out there and then also selling my work and making an income from that. But I also had a lot of curators, gallerists, people who work in galleries reach out to me with opportunities. And so, yeah, it just kind of, it happened very organically. There was no strategy on my end of like, how do I, you know, this is the plan. I'm going to take it like this. It was kind of like things came my way and it was just sort of taking it as it came. So a lot of the opportunities, I would say, like for gallery stuff, for any kind of show, came from Instagram. And yeah, I don't know. It was, I just kept moving with it. And I kept wanting to share my work, you know, so it wasn't like, I know now it's a little bit different too, because I hear a lot of young artists who will say like, well, how do I grow my Instagram account? How do I reach more people? And there's like all of these strategies for marketing essentially through social media. And at the time, like that was not at the forefront of my mind. I didn't know how any of that worked. I was just like, I've made this thing and I want to share it with people, you know? And because it happened organically, like to this day, that's still how I do it. I don't like think of things in that way. But yeah, you kind of just, I just kind of rolled with it and just kept it going. And fortunately, like it kept coming. So I never had to, I mean, obviously, like you said, like there's a trust element in yourself that, you know, whatever happens, you've got your own back. You know that you're going to make it, whatever that looks like. It may not look the way maybe you intended it immediately, but you know, you're not going to starve. You're going to figure it out. You might have to get a full-time job again, you know, and shift things, whatever it is. There was a lot of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And knowing that that's okay. Like all of those things are okay. And, you know, it's amazing. As you're speaking, I'm just kind of, it's a reminder that when we are in a really tight situation, which many of us have been in at some point, like we are more resourceful than we often think. And then we often realize, like what I always say, like when your back is against the wall, you figure out a way, you find a way. And like, sometimes it's hard, but like, it's kind of amazing when you realize not just how resilient you are, but like how do I say it? Like how you can problem solve when you're in a tight spot. You kind of surprise yourself, I think, sometimes. And reminding yourself as well, whenever you take a big leap of faith, and I feel like this connects to your journey and the leap of faith that you took with becoming a full-time artist, that the worst thing that could happen is often not that bad. Like even if you are down and out, you know, most of the time there's like a friend you could stay with if you had to, or like money you could borrow. Not saying that those things are ideal, but like you, there would be a solution. And I always share that when I started my company, I would have this like fear that I would, you know, wouldn't make it and I'd be like penniless on the street or something. And it's like, no, our brain goes to these places, but that's not actually going to happen ever. Do you feel like you've just through this journey developed a stronger sense of trust in yourself? And it sounds like now you're at a point where you feel really secure in what you're doing. And yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit more on that.
Yeah. So I feel like, I mean, one of my biggest things since, I mean, it's been a long time, but I have always really believed in listening to your intuition. And one of my biggest things has been honing that connection to that voice. I think there were a few moments in my, especially in my schooling, where I encountered, there's this artist named Agnes Martin. She's passed, but she made these really beautiful minimalist paintings. And she did this interview where she just talked about how essentially she was just a conduit for inspiration. So she just, it came from somewhere and she just let it come through her fingers onto a panel, a canvas, and there was no judgment on her end. And so I thought that was very beautiful, very zen, and it kind of lets go of a lot of control, you know, and just like that act, that is also a trust. So anyway, I thought that was really beautiful, and it made me question, like, you know, where does inspiration come from? Where do our ideas come from? All of that. And essentially, you know, the conclusion for me is that I think the intuition is closely tied to inspiration, consciousness, all of that stuff. So as I've journeyed further into my career, I always go back to that as like a point of like grounding. It's just listen to my gut, listen to what feels right. And sometimes, like right now, I do feel very secure. And one of the things that I've made sure to do over the years is save money. So I do enjoy, like, you know, the spending it when I have the opportunity, like vacations, whatever. Because, you know, like, why work so hard if you can't enjoy it? But I also make a point to prioritize saving. And that allows me more freedom in the long run. So I bring that up because right now, this year, I'm taking a break from solo shows. I have been just going. And I don't feel burnt out, but I think, you know, it could lead there. And so I wanted to take this year to just give myself like a rest without deadlines, without that pressure to create like a tight body of work and allow myself to play and be free and experiment in the studio and just like make a bunch of things that aren't successful or whatever. And because I've set myself up for that, I now have that freedom. So that's also risky. That's also like a, you know, what happens if a year passes and I don't feel like I want to do a solo show next year? I don't know. I don't know what that looks like. And sometimes, you know, I have those like plan C's, E's, whatever, D's, where it's like, what would I do if I had to change and shift completely? It still happens. But yeah, I think ultimately, like, I've proven myself to myself that I can just trust that, like you said, like, we are resilient. And the problem solving is, you know, when you're in a comfortable place, you think, oh no, like, what if XYZ happens? But yeah, when you are at a point where it's like a survival thing, then you figure it out. There is no question. There is no like, what if, you know, you just do it. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe I wouldn't be able to take this year off if I didn't fully trust myself, you know, but that's where I'm at. So there's some risk that comes with that, but yeah.
It's such a beautiful thing to hear you talking about it and how you're listening to your intuition and tapping into like, okay, I don't feel burnt out right now, but I could see it heading this way. So this is a preventative. I actually feel like that's a beautiful act of self-love and self-preservation, what you're doing. And it's also amazing that you've set yourself up so that financially, like, you can have this year. Yeah, it's because oftentimes when we reach that point where we enter burnout, and like, I've been there, I experienced this last year where I thought I was really sick for like 3 weeks. And then looking back, I'm like, oh my gosh, no, I was just really burnt out. But I was like physically sick, but I can see now that it was burnout. I had never experienced that before. And so this year I'm like taking more measures to, I'm still working a lot and all of that. But like when I start to notice those symptoms or whatever you want to call them creeping up, I'm like, okay, it's got to take a rest day, or even looking ahead in my calendar and like carving out rest days after I have a big event or like we're opening a show or something. But, and I also just think that when you take time to give yourself the permission to explore and play and just welcome that creative exploration in the studio, it is such a gift. I think it's the greatest gift you can give yourself as an artist, because it's like total freedom. And I've talked about this in previous episodes where, you know, I have moments, and I've spoken with artists who have shared this as well, where like, one of my biggest goals as an artist, because I'm a painter as well, is to get back to how I made art when I was a kid, you know? And you're just totally free. And you're just like grabbing random materials and you're mixing and you don't care. You're just making. Also, I love what you shared. Side note, I know of Agnes Martin's work, but I didn't know that her approach and philosophy, and that is like going to stay with me. And I'm definitely going to do a little bit of Googling and research after this recording. But yeah, for you to just say like, okay, I'm starting to feel like I could burn out, so let me take this time, but also let me take this time to just explore and not be so focused on creating a tight body of work, which is typically how it goes when you're preparing for a solo show. It's amazing. Like, I'm so excited to see what comes out for you and what you create. Have you already started to notice some really cool things happening? Like, how has it been so far since you've been doing that?
There have been some things. I mean, there's like some things in the background, but really what I've noticed is I've just allowed myself to like, I just jump from thing to thing. And so if I am working on something and I am like, oh, I have this idea, I can just go and do it. Versus when you are working on a solo show, you know, it's like 3 months, 4 months of work to make. And then, you know, you have to get to the deadline. You got to pack all the work, ship all the work, all the things. And you can't really give yourself that freedom to just, you're working in the studio, you need to finish a piece or a painting or whatever. You can't just be like, oh, idea, and then like run off and just let that whole day go, you know, especially if you time it right, maybe you can do that. And I have had shows where I've been able to do that, but there's this risk of, if I need, you know, 20 pieces for a show and I spend like 2 days just deviating and like making these experiments that fail and fail in a good way, but you know, then that eats into the time of me hitting that number of 20 pieces by this date. So yeah, what I've noticed is suddenly I'm free to just do that. And I don't think I've done that for a while, where I've been able to just like, I'll work on something and then I'll think, oh, what about this material that I bought like 6 months ago? Let me go just like play with that. And I play with it and then nothing comes of it. And then I go to the next thing. And it's sporadic. And it does feel very kid-like, where, you know, their attention spans are short. Maybe they get focused on something for a little bit and then they jump to the next thing. And it's playful. And it's weird because sometimes I'll have to check myself because I think, oh, I should finish something. I need to finish something. And it's like, oh no, like I see what these past few years of like working with deadlines has done, where there's this anticipation or expectation of a complete something. And that's also weird because now I'm like, oh, I don't have to finish anything. Like I don't need to do that. So yeah, it's like I've conditioned myself in a certain way over the past few years. And now I'm trying to undo that conditioning a little bit.
Yeah. As you were telling me, I'm like, it's so much undoing. It's so much unlearning, because you condition yourself. It also just reminds me of how like when we're working all the time, sometimes it can even feel overwhelming to step outside of the studio or to step outside of the work that we're doing, because it's like we get so used to that as well, and the expectations and societal pressures that come. Like I lately have been even feeling a little bit when I'm making my own art, like, oh my gosh, I feel like I should be doing something for my company and not making my own art, you know? And it's like, there's so much undoing and so much unlearning that has to take place for us to get back to that, like, I don't know, how, like, I guess more pure kind of, you know, like how you're describing your process. It's like, that's the way we created for the first 7, 8, 9, 10 years or however long of our lives before the conditioning really started. And I think it's just so beautiful that you're giving, yeah, like giving yourself this gift and giving yourself this space and letting go of the expectation of finishing everything. Because I think we also, as artists, even if we're process oriented, I think that many of us, I can certainly speak for myself, tend to put pressure on or a higher value on a finished piece. Like when something is finished, it has more value. But actually, so I had this epiphany the other night. It really was like a full revelation. I recorded it on my phone at like 11 o'clock at night. And I was like, the value is in making the work. It's not in the finished work. Like it's something that I knew conceptually, but it was the one of the first times in my life that I felt it. I was like, oh, I'm really getting this now. I understand now. Like, it's literally all about the decisions you're making and what you're discovering while you're making that thing. So for you to like carve out space to return to that is also really powerful.
Absolutely. I agree. It's like the end, the finished piece is just not proof, but it is a physical embodiment of that process, of that journey. And I think, you know, if you, I mean, personally, I do this where a lot of what I learn in my practice, my studio practice, it applies to real life. So how I approach situations or new people or new or change, you know, it's like you just accept, you roll with it. Things might happen that might not go the way you expect. But, you know, like all of these little lessons that you learn as you're making a piece, I think apply to real life. So it is very much about that process. It's about the decisions you're making, the choices you're making, the internal dialogue. You know, whatever is going on, the self-reflection. Yeah, because it all ties together. So I feel like if you're always waiting for the piece to be finished, then maybe that's how you approach life. At least that would set up my mindset for that. And I don't want that, you know?
Yeah, totally. It's like recognizing that. And it's a beautiful thing when you come to realize that there's so much more value in the process of making. And when you said like the internal dialogue, it's so true because you're connecting with yourself, you're processing emotions, you're going deep, and like, that's a beautiful thing. And I actually think that if like, it's such an amazing thing that artists do because it's a choice that we're making to carve out time and space to like go within ourselves and process these complex things and then create something out of it. Because like, normal life, regular life, like it's not built in. Like we have to, like we make a sincere effort to do this. And it's so powerful. You know, I often reference Beth Pickens, who wrote the book, Make Your Art No Matter What. And she also wrote Your Art Will Save Your Life, both really amazing and powerful books. And she, I think she references it in both books, but she talks about how like during the 2016 election, there were a lot of artists that felt like the work they were doing was not meaningful. Like they should step outside of the studio and they should only be like involved in things that they felt would be of more importance or like greater value. And Beth wrote the book, Your Art Will Save Your Life, in response to that, because she's like, so many artists I knew were feeling like what they were doing wasn't important in this time of like political crisis. But actually what I want to remind every creative and every artist is that the work you're doing is the most in the studio is the most important thing. Like you have to do that work to feel like yourself as an artist. And also if we think about, so I had this thought the other night that I think connects to what we're saying, where I was thinking about one of my favorite artists who has had such a profound impact on me and my practice. And I was like, what if that artist never made his work? Like I would, like, what if I never saw his work? I feel like I would be a different, I mean, I don't know if it's dramatic to say I'd be like a different person, but do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I can't even imagine never having seen his paintings. Like I don't know. It just changed so much for me. And so I don't know if you have those moments too, where you're like, I don't know if you ever like just kind of go through periods where it sounds like you're very secure in your practice and you know that this is what you're meant to be doing, but have you had moments where you've kind of felt like, oh, well, I don't know if this is important enough, or I don't know. I'm just think because I've had those moments, but I always try to remind myself that it is actually the most important thing.
Yeah, I've definitely had those moments. And I think a lot of that, I guess you would call it doubt maybe, or second guessing, comes from, it's a double-edged sword. It comes from social media, you know? Because if you're insulated and you're just alone in your studio all the time, maybe some of that self-doubt would creep in. But, you know, when you're hearing it from an external source, it can get under your skin a little bit. So I've definitely had moments like that where, because my work is playful and it's bright and it's you know, it's beautiful. And like those ideas or those feelings are inherently not serious. And there's something about, you know, even within like looking at art itself and thinking about art that is serious and important being like, because they deal with certain subject matter or they're addressing certain issues. Those are important and we deem them important, but also like, you know, human emotion and our experiences as people run the gamut. It's not just isolated to the serious or whatever is associated with those feelings. It's also those light moments, those happy moments. And so sometimes, yeah, I'm like, my work is just playful and like, you know, people could just look at it and just have like a moment where like, oh, that's cute or that's pretty and that's it. But when there is only darkness, those moments of lightness are really important because that is, I think that is hope, you know, that is like a reminder, like, hey, there's this other side to things. Yeah. When those thoughts creep in, if someone like comments on something and they're like, I don't know. I can't pinpoint anything specific, but yeah, it's just, it's a good way to remind yourself, like whatever it is you're making is important. At the very least, it's important to you just individually. And if you share it with the world and if it connects with one other person, then it is important. I think that's it. Yeah.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I have chills as you're saying all of this because it's so true. And it just reminds me of like, you know, I don't know if you had this experience too, but in art school, you know, I'm a landscape painter and I really view my work as an opportunity to explore more complex emotions. And I started to realize eventually it wasn't even about landscape. That's just kind of like the subject that I use to explore emotion and experience and all of these things and memory. But I remember when I was in college, art school, it was very much like, and I had, don't get me wrong, I had some amazing professors that did not feel this way, but I had some professors that were like, this is just decorative, or like, what is the, like, this isn't, you know, and like conceptual art was very, very just prioritized and valued. And it's like what you're saying is so true. All art is important. If it's important to you, it's important. And also, you know, painting or sculpting joy and hope, like it's actually one of the most important things in the world we live in, where there is so, you know, I'm like such an optimist, but there is so much negativity out there and there's so much darkness. And so to be creating work that is like, you know, joyful and bright and light is just so powerful. I just bought an original piece from a painter named Ingrid V. Wells, who's in San Francisco. And she talked, that's her mission, really. I mean, she'll speak about it much more eloquently and I've had her on the podcast, but her work is so joyful. It's so bright. I saw one of her paintings and I was like, I need that in my apartment. I just need to look at that every day. And so I think it's beautiful that that's also part of, you know, what you're doing. And just your work is, it's so bright, like not just in terms of the colors, but also just everything about it. It's fun and it's playful. And it's like, I can't stop looking at it. You know, I actually wanted to ask you, cause I feel like I haven't asked you so much about the work itself. And you mentioned that you were studying painting and drawing. What inspired you to transition into sculpture? And like, how did the drippy sculptures come to be?
So in undergrad, you know, when I was a kid, I was like, being an artist meant painting. I don't know why, you know, I don't know. When you're a kid, you have like these, those boundaries don't really exist. But as a kid, that's what it meant to me. And so that's why I went into school thinking like painting and drawing is the way to go. But it was this, I had like an art, a survey, I guess, of like it was freshman year or maybe sophomore year, but I was doing the survey and it was about the Impressionists. The chapter, the block we were in was about Impressionists. And it was just this like aha moment where, you know, the Impressionists were not accepted by, at the time, they were like kind of outcasts and like social pariahs for painting the way they painted. And the accepted art at the time was, they wouldn't be accepted into the Salon in France or whatever, however it worked back then. But anyway, their whole thing was painting a moment or a feeling, and it was fleeting. And the way it was explained to me was, you know, they suddenly were not so, they weren't emphasizing using paint as a means of creating illusion, creating something realistic. They wanted to capture something that was momentary. And so by doing that, they freed paint. Paint didn't have to act as something else. You can see the paint. So paintings used to look, you know, like modeled and representative of the real world. But suddenly now you could actually see the paint strokes. You could see the paint. And there was a new element to the painting. And I just thought that was amazing. Like I was just like, oh my God, like what a concept, what an idea to, we have this material, this medium that we have used for so long. And suddenly there was just a group of artists who were like, gesture, like it's just, let's just put it on there and let it be, let the material be. And I don't know, that was just so cool to me. So at the time, you know, I was painting, I was drawing all that. And then I thought, well, what could I use that isn't paint then? If the Impressionists did this with paint and they freed paint, do I have to paint? Do I have to use paint to make paintings? Do I have to use charcoal, you know, oil pastel, whatever? Like, do I have to use all of that to make it a drawing? So then I started exploring different ways to paint and draw without traditional paint and drawing mediums. So that's how it started. And then at the end of undergrad, I started getting into resin. At the time, it was like, there were no like, this was like 15 years ago. So there was no YouTube tutorials about resin. I found a place to get resin online, ordered it, messed around with it, figured out like all the mistakes that you figure out with resin. Like if it gets too hot, then it'll set quickly. If it mixes with this, it won't set, all the things. And it was really cool. So that was at the end of undergrad. And then I went into grad school, continuing my path with resin. And that's when I realized that I had an affinity for sculpture. Like I was like suddenly so drawn to sculpture because it was starting to get so textural and so three-dimensional that I was like, should I be making sculpture? Like, I don't know what's going on. But I honed it in for my thesis. I was like, okay, let me just continue staying on the wall. The pieces got very sculptural, but they were still on the wall. So technically they were still paintings. But yeah, that's when I realized like, oh, this actually comes really naturally to me, making three-dimensional objects. So yeah, after grad school, that's when I like just freed myself from those academic boundaries.
Because I was wondering like how that transition was and if it was, you know, just a moment you had where you're like, wait, I should be a sculptor, or if it was something that was like really, or it sounds like it was just a really organic process for you where you were leaning more into material and how you could use materials in sort of a new and innovative way. And again, it kind of comes back to what we were chatting about before with like just noticing and observing as you're making your work and like paying attention to those discoveries and following your intuition and realizing like, oh, wait, this feels more aligned. Creating in this way feels more exciting or whatever it might be. I think that's so cool. And also just, yeah, like I think it's amazing to just have the courage, honestly, to try something that is totally new. I feel like I'd be very nervous to try resin or anything. I'm like watercolor and acrylic and oil. But I did work with beeswax for a while and I had somewhat of a similar experience where I did encaustic and it was like the textures and just like the physicality of working with the paint mixed with the wax was really, really, really special and kind of like awakened something in me as well. How would you say, so like your work today, how has it evolved like since that moment where you decided you were going to shift into sculpture? How has it evolved over time, like to where it is now?
I mean, I think it has refined a lot you know, so one of the things that I had realized about myself when I was in school was I did like to jump around a lot. And I think this is a thing that happens a lot with like young artists. And it's one of those things where if you can sort of hone in on something that really interests you, then you can, it's a never ending rabbit hole. You can just keep going. And it's really, I think that's where your voice comes out. So when you're in school, yeah, try all the things, try everything, do whatever you can. But once you find something that really takes hold of you and like has your interest and you just deep dive, I think that's where like, you know, originality, your voice, your style can start to really like blossom and be apparent. Cause it just isn't going to happen without that level of, I guess, commitment to something, to an idea. But in grad school, I dealt a lot with ideas of beauty and repulsion. And I still deal with that in my work, but I think it has skewed more towards this like lighter, brighter, playful. And it's interesting that you brought up your experience in school because I went through a very similar thing where I had professors who were like, it's beautiful. It doesn't mean anything. So what? You know? And some of these professors, the one specifically, he would not accept my explanation of what I was presenting. And I'm like, no, like at the time I was working with, like, I wanted to capture emotion on like a panel I wanted to make it a physical thing. I wanted to take emotion from inside and put it out there as a physical object. And you know, I found that like a lot of the flowy materials that I use, like the resin and stuff, really like could convey that feeling, that sort of ever-changing quality of emotions. And, you know, I had specific emotions I was trying to convey and all of that. But anyway, I presented it to him and he was like, no, it's pretty, but like, it doesn't mean anything. And you can't like, he was like, emotions, like, no. And I was like, well, and then I had been doing a lot of research and I brought up Agnes Martin. And I was like, well, also like there's this other element where I very much am trying to listen to my intuition and just let things flow and be and create without judgment, because I think that is so important. Even then I was like, this feels like a truth. This feels right. And he just wouldn't accept it. He just was like, nope. And so because I felt like it was true, and I felt it in my bones, I stood my ground and I continued with the work that I wanted to make. But then I brought in this other element of like, okay, well, if your feedback is that something is too pretty, and if it's too pretty, it means there's no content. There's nothing deeper there. It's just beautiful. And that's not true. You know, like I don't. So then I brought in this other element of like, okay, well, what happens when it's too beautiful? What happens then? And I use this analogy of like, if you're eating a beautiful piece of cake and it's just gorgeous and you just want to eat it and devour it, and then you start having too much, it starts to become kind of gross and, you know, you're like, you feel a little sick. So I started bringing that into my work where I'm just like pushing the button as far as how beautiful I can make something. And then when does it cross over into like saccharine, like too much, too over the top? So that's what my grad school work was about. And that was the space that I lived in for a while. And now time has gone on. You know, I've refined my process. I've learned my materials. I still introduce new materials into my work, but it's deviated, you know, it's like gone through different lenses, I guess. I still deal with ideas of beauty a lot, but you know, more recently, like I think I've been thinking a lot more about like consciousness, reality, what looking at something and interpreting what that means and then like the context of that. So like, you know, so, but I still deal with ideas of beauty. And then it goes back to also the other thing we were talking about making joyous, happy things. Beauty is not something to be disregarded. Like I think evolution, like as humans, like in an evolutionary way, beauty has led us, it is a part of survival, I think. So we can just disregard it. A lot of times people just like dismiss it, think it's nothing, whatever. But there is a lot of content there. And I think it was interesting because while I was in grad school, I had another professor. She was a woman. I told her my experience with this male professor. And she told me, and I had never thought about this before. I don't know why, but I had never thought about this before. She was like, oh, he doesn't understand because he's a guy. And I was like, what? And she was like, you're talking about emotions. You're talking about intuition. You're talking about creating from the space that is not just like all up here. And she's like, it's because you're a woman. Like, we are in tune with something that men don't grow up being in tune with generally. You know, she was just speaking in generalities, but it just never occurred to me. And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, it blew my mind a little bit. And I was just like, well, so then there's another element to this, right? Where you're making beautiful things and suddenly it's nothing. It's disregarded because it's beautiful. But then that's also an association with femininity. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, but, yes. So anyway, that's how I've arrived at the work that I make today.
Oh gosh, it's such a beautiful explanation. I feel like the way you talk about your work, you can just tell that you're so immersed in it. Like, you just speak about it so beautifully and you know it so well. Like, it can just feel that from you. Like, you just know the work so well. And that's an amazing thing because it's constantly changing and evolving and shifting. And yeah, I was wondering when you were telling me the story about the professor as well, my first thought was, I wonder if he felt triggered in some way because maybe he never allowed himself to, I don't know, explore intuitively or open himself up to, you know, like, because I think oftentimes when people just shut things down, it's typically like a mirror of something that they feel either insecure about or have not allowed themselves to do or whatever it might be. But I think, yeah, that's also such a great explanation. As women, we are very in tune with our intuition and it's such a gift. And I think using that as a gift, I mean, I've shared that I'm at the point in my life now where nearly all of the decisions I make are intuitive. Like, they're all pretty much intuitive. And sometimes people don't understand that. But I think using that as a tool in your art, in your work, in your creativity, and allowing it to really guide you and serve as like that compass is such a powerful thing because that's when you start making work that is so deeply aligned to you. And just circling back to you taking this year, it's almost like you're taking like a personal residency in a way, you know, and like,
yeah.
Like, it's kind of like that. I mean, it's such a gift. And I feel like when you do that, also every time I think you use your intuition, it strengthens, like it's a muscle and it gets stronger. And when you give yourself that gift of time and space to create and really lean in to what it is you want to make and how that might change and just giving yourself permission, that also kind of strengthens your intuition because you're just practicing. Now that you're not thinking so much about how am I going to create this series for this show and this and that, you can kind of dial deeper into what it is you really want to be making. You can dial deeper into those discoveries and just kind of working in an even more intuitive way, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is a lot of like, I think the biggest hurdle is like kind of like that, what we had mentioned earlier about like the conditioning and just reminding yourself that your intuition is the compass. I think sometimes this may be very like not one of my insecurities, but you know, like as I'm like making the work and whatever, and like one of those external sources or voices that can like sometimes come in, it's like, you know, I'm in the art world. I have goals just like everyone else. Like I would love to have my work in more museums. I want to continue and progress in my career. But sometimes, you know, I think because of the way my work is and the associations with the happy, the beautiful, the light, whatever, sometimes my work is not taken as seriously. And then this voice comes in that's like, well, you know, maybe your work needs to be more intellectual. And it's like this, almost this pressure to prove yourself, you know, to prove that like it is what I'm saying it is, just like in school. But then I remind myself, like, I'm not in school anymore. And I don't have to listen to anybody. If I believe in my work, I believe in myself, then it is what it is, you know? And if people can recognize it for what it is, that's great. If they don't, that's okay too. Like, it's okay if I don't have my museum solo, you know, 20 years down the road, whatever it is. I just have to be okay with all of it because I know that I am listening to my intuition and I'm doing the best that I can. So, you know, if it works out, it works out.
Yes, 100%. It's something I've also really grappled with, you know, working in the realm of landscape and feeling like this pressure to overly intellectualize like what it is I'm creating, when really it's like, well, yes, I'm exploring, you know, emotion and memory and these like things that I think are quite complex. But at the same time, I also genuinely, like, I love creating beautiful work that I feel is beautiful. And sometimes I do a painting and there's really, it's not that deep. It's just a pure expression of what I was feeling in that moment. And that's also really like, there's something profound in that. And it just, in that piece, just being a pure expression of what I was feeling, like, that's important. It's so much undoing. It's so much unlearning. I loved art school, but yeah, it's still something that I like hear those tapes playing in my head sometimes, like also like 15 years later. And, you know, I teach a workshop for artists to help them write about their work. And that's always like the number one thing I say. I'm like, don't feel when you are writing about your work that you have to overly intellectualize it. Write about what it means to you. Write about your personal connection to it. And, you know, what you want to convey or why it's important to you. But don't, like, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be this. I think there's just this idea that if it's, I don't know, if it's just an expression of beauty or a raw expression of emotion, like, it's not as serious. But actually, if we take a step back, we realize those things are so important. This is like part of the human experience. And so just reminding yourself, and like you're saying, if you believe in your work and you stand behind it, that's the most important thing. And there will, no matter what you're creating, even if you're like a conceptual artist and your work is like, I don't know, I'm just thinking whatever the opposite of my art would be. There will be people that love it and there will be people that don't appreciate it, no matter what you are creating. So you just have to create what brings you joy and makes you happy and what feels good and what feels aligned. And you know, I try to remind myself of this all the time. Like it goes the same way with, there are will be people that like you and they're, I'm like, I can be the best version of myself I can possibly be. There will be people that don't like me. It doesn't have anything to do with me. There will be people that don't like my art. It has nothing to do with what, like, the value of the art. I think the more you can remind yourself of that, it's helpful, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's super important to do. If maybe even at first you try to block all of that out, you know, to begin with.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes when you are public facing or have your work is out there, it's hard because you have that internal back and forth sometimes, but then you get the external sources and those extra comments and voices and all of that, that can add to the turmoil. I don't know. Maybe it's not that bad, but yeah.
No, totally. One thing I'm really practicing is when I get a negative comment or email or whatever it might be, I just will literally say to myself, like, it wasn't for this person. It has nothing to do with me or my work. It just wasn't for this person. And also if it's something really bad that someone says, I'm like, I just send love to whoever this is, because this has nothing to do with me, like absolutely nothing to do with me. But yeah, it reminds me of, like, you know, if you think about like your favorite song, which, and you think it's like the best song ever, you're like, I have no idea how someone could not like this song. It's so beautiful. There are people out there that don't like that song. Or like your favorite ice cream flavor, you know, it's like silly examples, but it's, your art is not for everyone. And that's so, like, my art is not forever. Just in general, the work that we make, we can't, and I've spoken a little bit more about this on the podcast this season, you can't make your work ever based on external expectations if you think people are going to like it or not, because you can't do that. You just have to, as you're saying, and I think you're really driving this point home, like, you just have to make the work that feels good to you. And it sounds like you really trusted yourself even when you had a professor that didn't believe in your work. Also, I just want to add, you're so vulnerable when you're in art school. Your professors, what they say is like everything to you. It's, yeah, like their word is like, I feel like all it would take was a professor to tell me like one comment. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to change everything. You know,
like, yeah.
Like, your word is the law. Because you see them as just, you know, these like, gosh, it's a whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. There's so much respect there, you know, and you look at them as like, they are doing it. They're artists. They're showing their work, you know, so they were like your role models. And yeah, if a professor that you respected and liked said just one thing, it could like change your whole world. It could change your worldview. Like maybe, you know, but, yeah, it's very impactful. One thing that I wanted to mention too, so last year I got really into Rick Rubin. He talks a lot about the things that we're talking about. And I think I find one of the things that's really, really cool about listening to other creatives talk is that there is a thread that is connected through all of our experiences that, again, I think is like a truth. In any creative endeavor. So like you mentioned not creating based on what other people like or for other people. It's only listen to yourself. And Rick Rubin writes, he wrote a book last year. And he's done like a lot of podcast interviews and all of that. And he mentions the exact same thing where it's like, it's pointless really to create for other people. It has to be you. It has to be from you. And in that, it is authentic. And then, yeah. And then you let it out into the world. And, you know, and yeah, some people like it. Some people don't. You can't make it for everybody.
It's kind of like surrendering, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like letting it go. Like you make it and then you release it. And then you just kind of allow whatever happens to happen, in the sense that the people, like, I think trusting, going back to this idea of trust, like trusting whoever is meant to connect with this will connect with it. And whoever's not, they'll find a different artist or different work that does resonate with them and they do connect with. And yeah, I think there is a lot of like trust and surrender and just in following your intuition that's involved in the creative process and in building a career as an artist. And, I think that's all you can do is just make the work that feels good for you to make, and also allowing that to change, you know, like who knows, maybe one day I might want to do like something completely different. Maybe I want to be an abstract painter one day. Like, I don't know. I'm okay with not knowing, and being okay with that, accepting that is important, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's another reality of like what's, like, you know, if you're a full-time artist, like me, for example, and I'm known for a certain kind of work, you know, what if like one day I don't want to make that work anymore? What happens?
This is juicy because this has come up so much on the podcast. I get asked this all, like artists, I think, wonder about this all the time, myself included. It's like, what happens if a day comes where I want to do something totally different, but I've already like built this recognizable, identifiable, I mean, you said brand, and I mean, yes, in a way it is absolutely a brand that you're building. It is a business that you're building. So what are your thoughts on that? I'm so curious.
I don't know. I really don't know. It's tough because there was a, who was it? I forget what band it was, but there was a band that, they were talking about, how when they do tours now, people are always like, play that one song, right? And it's like some bands, like Radiohead, I think, are like, no, absolutely not. You know, we're only playing our new music or something like that. So there's that approach. But this other band that I don't remember who it was, but they're a big one. And they were like, of course I'm going to play that song. These people are here to hear like some of the hits. And there are people here who have never heard it before. And that's my bread and butter. So like, I want to share that. I love the song. I want to share it with the world and continue to share it if people want to hear it. And I think that's really beautiful. And so I think as long as you are still into whatever it is, then you can just continue to do it. But yeah, the tricky part is when you're not into it anymore. So what do you do? If that day comes, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. I just hope that like the people who support my work continue to support the change. But I guess I just ultimately would just have to do whatever's right for me. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's okay. It's okay not to have, like, I remind myself of that too. It's okay to not know. I think we can't really, there's no way of knowing actually. But I think also connecting this back to trust, it's like, well, I would trust that, yeah, like either the people that continue or have supported me would continue to support me in the work that I'm creating, even if it's very different. Or like, you know, maybe they'll leave, but like new people will come in that love this new approach, this new body of work. And actually, this is something that, what is her name? Kara Alwa-Labaya. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but she's an amazing author. She wrote Girl on Fire and a bunch of other really great books. And she talks about this idea a little bit of how when you change your style, you might lose a few people, but more will come who connect with that new style or body of work or whatever it is. So I think it's like, there's no way of really knowing until that day comes, if that day comes, but also leaning again into trust that the right people will always, you'll attract them, you'll find them, they'll find you, and they will be, it could be an entirely new audience, you know? You never know. Oh, amazing. Dan, I literally feel like we could just continue the conversation for many more hours. Love chatting with you. Like, what a joy to have you on and learn more about your work and just your approach, your journey, your philosophy and everything is so inspiring. I feel like very uplifted right now. Where can our amazing listeners learn more about you and your work?
So I am on Instagram and I'm on TikTok as Sopopomo. And then I also have a website, bydanlam.com. Yeah. I mean, you can find what I'm up to on those. I haven't been very active of late, but that's where you can keep up to date with me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Like, truly, this is an incredible conversation. And I just loved hearing your thoughts on everything, the creative process. I'm so excited for this personal residency, so to speak, that you have this year. And I can't wait to, I'm so excited to see what you create. I know it's going to be amazing.
Thank you. That really means a lot. Just to know that there's, you know, other people out there trusting me as I trust myself.
Yes, absolutely. It will be incredible. Can't wait to see it. And thank you again. And to our listeners, as always, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Thank you for tuning in and supporting our platform. To learn more about New Visionary Magazine, head over to visionaryartcollective.com/magazine. You can order individual copies on Amazon or subscribe annually to digital issues. We also have opportunities to get featured in the magazine, so be sure to join our newsletter and follow us on Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to leave a review on iTunes or tag us on Instagram. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.